This is Morning Edition on Vermont Public Radio. Good morning, I'm Mitch Wertlieb. Geography, personal insecurity, and poverty are just some of the powerful forces that my guest today has struggled with and against in becoming a writer. And that may be surprising to some because Angela Palm's memoir, Riverine, is a triumph of a book, named the winner of the 2015 Grey Wolf Prize for Nonfiction. But digging into the story of Palm's childhood in northwestern Indiana, where the Kankakee River flooded so much it turned her home into an island, and following the story of a childhood friend she fell in love with and continued to love even after he was convicted of a double murder, it's easy to understand how self-doubt was a constant companion for Angela Palm, even as she succeeded in producing an award-winning book. Angela Palm joins me now in our VPR studios to talk about Riverine, and thank you so much for being here.
Thanks for having me.
You seem acutely aware of both your physical and emotional surroundings growing up. How did living near the Kankakee River in Indiana have a lasting effect on who you are today?
You know, it's one of those places where we spent a lot of time outside doing things, and it was kind of an ideal place for kids because it offered a lot of adventure. And I think because of that, we became aware of the river's sort of cultural history and kind of shaped who I was. And in the early part of the book, I talk about the different things that we did that I sort of assumed that every kid was doing, shooting bows and arrows and spearing fish and making canoes from deerskin and shellacking them and having canoe races in the river. So it was really a powerful place to be.
But the river would flood on more than one occasion.
It would flood, yeah.
You'd become isolated when that happened.
We would. And some people had it much worse than we did even. But the water would come up, you know, oftentimes all the way up to essentially where the floor of the house was.
Did you ever have any sense that you were growing up poor, or did that only occur to you later on?
No, that's such an interesting question because, you know, when I hear people talk about the book and talk about poverty, a lot of people that I grew up around might take offense to that or not feel like that was them. But the reality was that lots of people were living below the poverty line or like a working class poor. And my family was always sort of just a little bit even above that, kind of like lower middle class. But, you know, living there gave me the opportunity to see, you know, very different levels of poverty. And later in college, so I went to college in the same area, I learned a lot about homelessness and food insecurity, and that there are actually very high levels of that in our rural county and all over the United States.
A central figure in your life growing up was a boy named Corey.
Mm-hmm.
From the beginning, you had a connection, and again, geography plays a bit of a role here. Your houses were close to each other. You could see, you know, each other's bedroom windows. How would you characterize your relationship with Corey?
Now or then?
Start with then.
Okay. So then he was, you know, my playmate, my first playmate. And he was a very fun, sort of open-hearted, big-eyed, big-smiled boy who had tons of energy and was always really kind to little kids. And since he was a little bit older than my brother and I, he was like our big brother for a long time. And then as we got older, things changed a bit, and I really became my first crush, at which time our lives kind of started to diverge a bit because he was getting into trouble. He had a very different family than I had, parents who weren't necessarily around keeping an eye on him, kind of on his own in some ways. And a lot of the families around the neighborhood took him in at different times. But he was ultimately kind of on a bad path, got arrested for different things and ended up in juvie, as we called it. And we spent less and less time together, but the love that was growing for him was always there. And then, you know, after the big, terrible crime happened, I didn't see him for 16 years, and I wasn't allowed to communicate with him after that happened.
Who was telling you that?
Oh, my parents. You know, I would have liked to write him, to talk to him, but it wasn't something we were even allowed to talk about, really. And, you know, there was just always something about him that I just couldn't let go, couldn't get past. I couldn't understand no matter how many ways I tried to look at it, you know, intellectually, academically, emotionally. There was always this sort of unsolved problem of how that happened. And what did it mean about me that I still had these feelings for him, sort of? I guess my greatest fear was that he was a monster of some kind, and I didn't see that, and that was worrisome. But when I heard back from him, you know, he was in his mid-30s by then. It really surprised me how tender he was and how smart and how articulate. And that really got me to thinking, like, what a wasted life, which led to, you know, a lot of research into prisons and how we punish people and those sorts of things.
Can you talk a little bit about the crime?
I tried not to, go too deeply into details about the crime in the book because I didn't want to, you know, make it harder on people's families than it already had been. But the crime itself started as a burglary. I think that he was robbing people and went into the home, confronted by the couple that lived there. And according to him, he had brought a knife with him to open the door. And something happened within that confrontation where it turned into a brutal murder. And then he fled, stole their car, and set it on fire a couple towns away.
Is it fair to say, as I characterized it in the lead, that you did love him? You were in love with him?
I say that now. I don't think I realized that or used those words at the time, but looking back on it, it felt like love to me. But I don't know if that's just a deep bond that you have with a person. You know, it's such a complicated thing. But I did feel that. I didn't say it until now, but...
Well, so much of this is wrapped up, too, in your efforts to become a writer, to find out who you wanted to be. You moved away from Indiana. You moved to Vermont. Vermont looms large in this story mm-hmm. as well. What brought you here, and what kind of impact has the move to Vermont had on your life?
We came here. So my husband is an airline pilot, and I was an editor working from home at the time. I had the flexibility to work hours from home and not have to go into an office so that I could work remotely. We really wanted to get out of Indiana, out of Indianapolis. We wanted to bring our kids to a place where they could have a real outdoors-based life and where that was really valued. Mike really loves a beautiful vista, and Burlington was on our short list because he had a lot of overnights here for work at the time, so we thought that he would be home a little bit more. And we kind of moved here, not quite sight unseen, but just on the promise of what we had heard about Burlington and the one or two visits that we had made here. I really fell in love with this city. It just felt like a comfortable place for a family like us.
So you had a background already as an editor in writing, but you really wanted to become a writer. You wanted to give voice, to yourself.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd love for you to read a section from the book Riverine. You came across a Border Patrol agent who asked what your profession was.
Sure. I leveled my smile, hardened my eyes. I matched my face to the customs agent's, something I'd learned that humans do to indicate trust. The long answer, the storied answer, compressed and collapsed in a blink, and I uttered rather unconfidently, "I'm a writer?" It came out sounding like a question rather than a statement, "I'm a writer." The reply echoed in my mind, "Was that what I did for a living?" Well, it was a living in that I was living it, not that I was paid per se, not yet, but that I suppose that it was time I called myself a writer publicly. The officer looked almost amused. Almost. She definitely did not believe me. Worse, I did not believe myself.
It's amazing to me because I read that section, I hear you say it, and I find it hard to believe. This is a book that has, just as we said, won a major prize for nonfiction. Do you still struggle with expressing with confidence that you are a writer now?
I don't now, but only until very recently, and the prize was very validating for that. I definitely even still sometimes fall into the imposter syndrome a little bit, that despite evidence to the contrary, you still don't believe something about yourself. And I don't know why that is. I guess because writing doesn't come like a 9-to-5 job. And so it looks very different and it feels very different. And one thing I like to say about this, too, is that writing and language is something that we all participate in, and stories is something that we all sort of collectively own together. So for someone to say, like, I own stories more than someone else, or I own language more than someone else, and it's my profession, is a little bit of a harder transition to make, I think. It's not as clear.
What are you working on now?
I'm working on two things, a novel about digital inheritance. So now you can will your passwords and electronic belongings to somebody, which I just find endlessly fascinating and just full of, like, opportunities to create plot around different things that could come up around that. So I'm writing about a woman who inherits her sister's digital property, essentially, and discovers that her sister's a very different person than what she was led to believe. And then I'm working on a critical essay collection about consumerism and capitalism and rage and ambivalence in America.
Light topics.
Yeah, you know, no big deal.
Angela Palms, the author of Riverine. I want to thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you so much for having me. This was really wonderful.